production of Columbia University Center for New Media Teaching and Learning.
Tonight, I'm going to talk about Harlem during the period of the 1930s and the 1940s. And the text I'm going to read from is my biography of Malcolm X. For the last 8 years, I've been doing research on Malcolm X. My biography is entitled Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention. So I'm going to read a section from the chapter on Detroit Red, Malcolm X in Harlem during the 1940s. But before I read that, I wanted to remind people that, again, next week, for week six, October the 9th, we're covering the material in week six. Tonight, we are not going to go around and do three-minute presentations about what your papers are. But that is going to be covered during week nine, which is October the 30th, if you look ahead at your syllabus to page 13. Okay? So what I'm going to do tonight is to read from the paper on Malcolm X, and then I'll talk about Harlem and Malcolm during the 1940s. Okay. Malcolm Little could not have lived and worked in Harlem during the Second World War and not have been affected by that community's turbulent history and extraordinary political and cultural activities. By any standard, by 1940, Harlem had become the most cosmopolitan and complex center for black political activity, not only in black America, but throughout the world. Roughly one quarter of Harlem's black population then consisted of West Indian immigrants, primarily from Jamaica, Barbados, Trinidad, British Guyana, and other British colonies, nearly all of whom had established their own political associations, parties, and political clubs of all kinds. One of Harlem's most influential West Indian politicians, Hulun Jack, originally from St. Lucia, had been elected as a Democrat to represent the neighborhood in the New York State Assembly in 1940. Harlem was also the national center of black labor activism, headed by A. Philip Randolph, who had initiated his legendary career as a Harlem public orator even before Marcus Garvey's arrival in the United States in 1916. Thousands of Harlem residents were active members and supporters of the Communist Party USA. Harlemite communists like Claudia Jones and Benjamin Davis were widely respected and popular leaders. Despite the demise of the Garvey movement, Harlem's militancy had grown more intense, chiefly around grievances concerning economic issues during the Depression-era 1930s. For example, black workers in public laundries routinely earned $3 per week less in wages than whites who performed identical work. Employment discrimination was rampant. One 1920 to 1928 survey of 250 Harlem businesses employing over 2,000 workers found that only 163 employees were black, and all in low-wage jobs. As the Great Depression deepened, black joblessness soared in Harlem. Black youth unemployment was estimated during the 1930s well above 50%. In 1935, the federal government's Works Progress Administration, the WPA, which had determined that the cost of living for maintaining a New York City household at maintenance level was $1,375 annually in New York City, estimated that the average black family's total income was only at $1,025. The harsh, unequal realities of race and class prompted the mobilization of Harlem's black community. In 1931, the Harlem Housewives League initiated a campaign at Harlem chain stores, insisting that they employ African Americans. Many Garveyites and black businessmen joined the new movement, urging Negroes to support a buy black effort. In 1932, the Harlem Labor Union was created, which quickly attracted many black nationalists and the unemployed West Indians. The union picketed whites-owned stores in the neighborhood that refused to hire blacks. In 1933, the Citizens League for Fair Play was formed, a popular coalition of over 40 organizations, including women's organizations, religious and fraternal groups, demanding greater Negro employment in Harlem businesses. By 1934, these organizing efforts culminated into mass public meetings and widespread picket lines. In March 1935, protests sparked a small riot in Harlem along 125th Street, involving several thousand people. Dozens of white-owned stores were looted. 57 civilians and 7 police officers sustained injuries. Police arrested 75 people, mostly African Americans, on charges ranging from inciting to riot, felonious assault, malicious mischief, and burglary. The NYPD's treatment of the rioters and its brutal actions in the upheaval's aftermath were subsequently documented by liberal Republican Fusion Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia's Commission on Conditions in Harlem. Police had made derogatory and threatening remarks. One police officer shot and killed one young black man who was running without warning. Another policeman, quote, called to arrest an unarmed drunk, hit the drunk so hard that he died, unquote. Cops illegally carried out frisks of pedestrians and so-called rioters, searching for numbers or policy slips to bust up Harlem's underground numbers racket. The liberal LaGuardia administration sought to diffuse Harlem's discontent by implementing many of the riot commission's recommendations. So from 1936 to 1941, the LaGuardia administration backed the construction of 2 new Harlem schools, the Harlem River Houses Public Housing Complex, and the construction of the Women's Pavilion at Harlem Hospital. LaGuardia consulted frequently with the black middle class's moderate political elite, notably National Urban League Director Lester Granger and NAACP Executive Secretary Walter White. The mayor's efforts to placate Harlem voters were recognized in February 1940 when the local branch of the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History honored him at the Schomburg Collection of the New York Public Library, praising LaGuardia for, quote, his efforts to improve race relations, unquote. But LaGuardia's constructive concessions did little to alter the widespread poverty and political discontent among Harlem's working class and among the unemployed. When the U.S. Supreme Court in 1938 declared that public picketing of private business establishments over racially based complaints was constitutional, a new round of Harlem protest ensued. The new Don't Buy Where You Can't Work coalition quickly won major concessions from white businesses. Within several years, about one-third of all clerks and white-collar employees in Harlem were African-American. In parallel efforts, blacks won employment concessions to work as telephone repairmen and operators, to drive buses for the Fifth Avenue and the New York omnibus companies, and to hold white-collar positions in Consolidated Edison, which was a company that blacks were largely excluded from prior to 1940. What is most significant about Harlem's struggles during the 30s and the early 40s is that Harlem established a model of social reform and urban protest that would later be replicated across America during the civil rights era two decades later. In the case of Harlem, mass agitation, mostly by grassroots associations and organizations, unions, and churches around specific racial grievances, culminated first in a series of well-publicized public demonstrations. Second, these were followed by urban insurrection. Third, a liberal government, whether local or federal, supported by white and Negro elites, subsequently negotiates concessions in the form of new hospitals, public housing, expanded Negro opportunities for employment in both the public and the private sector. Those reforms, in turn, spawned the political environment for the rise of the new African-American victories within electoral politics, the courts, and the government. The key elements of what became the protest strategy for winning locally based reforms during the civil rights movement a generation later were conceived not in Birmingham, Montgomery, or Atlanta, or in rural Mississippi, but they were largely framed and conceived by the struggles around the tenements of Harlem during the 1930s and the 1940s. In effect, many of the strategies in the protests and the tactics that we think of belonging to the 60s and the civil rights movement actually respond and created in the early 40s right here in Harlem. The primary political beneficiary of these successful political reforms in Harlem, if one had to choose one individual, was the Reverend Adam Clayton Powell, Jr. Born in 1908, Powell was the son of the powerful pastor of Harlem's Abyssinia Baptist Church, Adam Clayton Powell, Sr. Educated at Colgate University in upstate New York and Columbia University's Teachers College, Powell, Jr. followed his father into the ministry, but his overriding interests were hardly spiritual. In 1931, young Powell led a protest at New York City's Board of Estimates that successfully halted the exclusion of five African-American physicians from practicing at Harlem Hospital. In 1938, Powell had joined with Randolph and others to launch the Greater New York Coordinating Committee for Employment, which used pickets and nonviolent protests to secure African-American jobs. Succeeding his father as Abyssinian's pastor in 1937, Powell possessed a strong religious constituency as well as a growing army of political supporters and volunteers for his many causes. Ideologically and politically, Powell was a pragmatic liberal. In Harlem, Powell worked frequently and cooperatively with the Communist Party. At the national level, he endorsed Roosevelt's New Deal administration. Locally, he supported LaGuardia's reelection campaign as mayor in 1941, although LaGuardia was technically a Republican. That same year, Powell started the People's Committee, a Harlem-based mass organization of 1,800 campaign workers and 8 offices dedicated to the election of the charismatic minister to the New York City Council. Powell's challengers on the left and the right, American Labor Party candidate Dr. Max Yergin of City College, and Republican candidate Channing Tobias, respectively, pulled out of the contest in Powell's favor. LaGuardia endorsed Powell, and the two liberals campaigned together, both achieving victory. Once elected to city council, however, Powell astutely used his post to promote Harlem's continuing grievances. When Yergin, a history instructor at the nearly all-white City College located in West Harlem, was not reappointed to his academic position, largely on political grounds, Powell introduced in February 1941 Resolution Number 31, demanding the banning of racial discrimination in academic appointments at City University, at the City College. In May 1942, Powell's organization sponsored a mass rally at the Golden Gate Ballroom to protest NYPD brutality in the beating and killing of a young black man, Wallace Armstrong. In January 1943, when the LaGuardia administration granted the U.S. Navy permission to establish training facilities for the racially segregated Women's Reserve, the WAVES, at Manhattan's Hunter College and Walton High School, Powell bitterly denounced the action as a hypocritical capitulation to the federal government's segregationist Jim Crow policies. Powell's bold position was embraced by civil rights organizations, by black labor, and by the communists because it represented what they called the Double V campaign, Double V, victory abroad and victory over racism at home, championing the defeat of both fascism and racial discrimination. In response to blacks' modest gains in employment, thousands of white workers participated in what are called hate strikes during the war, demanding the exclusion of Negroes, especially from skilled positions. In July 1943, white racists briefly paralyzed Baltimore's Bethlehem shipyards at Sparrows Point because of the threat of Negroes being hired. Only the result, resolute action by the Liberal Congress of Industrial Organizations, the CIO, unions that were involved, as well as the shipbuilders, electricians, and steelworkers, suppressed the hate strike. In August 1944, Philadelphia white streetcar drivers, outraged at the assignment of eight black motormen, staged a six-day strike that shut down public transportation in Philadelphia. In response, President Roosevelt dispatched 5,000 troops into Philadelphia and issued an executive order placing the streetcar company under army control. This is all over the hiring of eight black men. The city shut down during a war. It's unbelievable. None of these events were lost upon African Americans, many of whom now questioned their participation and support for America's war effort. Years later, novelist James Baldwin recalled, quote, "The treatment accorded to the Negro during the Second World War marks for me a turning point in the Negro's relationship to America. A certain hope died. A certain respect for white Americans faded," unquote. Thousands of young African American males began refusing to register for the draft. Others sought to disqualify themselves from military service due to health reasons or other disabilities. One obscure black religious sect, the Nation of Islam, led by a middle-aged Negro male calling himself Elijah Muhammad, openly exhorted followers to refuse to register for the draft. In September 1942, the FBI rounded up nearly 100 African Americans for draft resistance. The defendants belonged to three organizations: the Nation of Islam, the Brotherhood of Liberty for Black People of America, and the Peace Movement of Ethiopia. When questioned by the FBI, Elijah Muhammad brassly stated that, for the record, that, quote, "Allah has taught that blueprints of a plane which carries bombs was given to the Japanese from the holy city of Mecca, and that these blueprints had been there for thousands of years. These bombs would go into the earth at least a mile and would throw up earth for a distance of 1 mile, so that it would make a mountain," quote unquote. The majority of those arrested claimed to be Muslims. 56 defendants were tried, convicted, and received 3-year prison terms. One son of Elijah Muhammad, Emmanuel Karim, was given 5 years in prison. Elijah Muhammad was charged with sedition. Following his conviction, Elijah Muhammad remained incarcerated in a federal penitentiary until his release in August 1946. Back in Harlem, on April the 22nd, 1943, the Savoy Ballroom was padlocked by the NYPD on the alleged grounds that servicemen had been solicited by prostitutes on its premises. The Savoy's closing had been prompted by Assistant Police Commissioner Cornelius O'Leary, who justified the action because of concerns over public health. New York City's Bureau of Social Hygiene had cited evidence that over a 9-month period in 1942, 43,164 individuals, quote, have met the source of their venereal disease at the Savoy Ballroom, unquote. 43,000 people. Okay. These alleged cases came from Navy, Army, and Marines, and Coast Guard personnel. As historian Russell Gold has observed, quote, this is suspect testimony because no evidence was provided to explain how they knew that their servicemen or other citizens had contracted their venereal diseases from prostitutes at the Savoy instead of from their wives, girlfriends, or contacts with prostitutes elsewhere, unquote. Good point. When on April the 20th, 1943, the appellate division of the New York State Supreme Court ruled unanimously to uphold O'Leary's actions, Mayor LaGuardia declared that he was powerless to stop the Savoy's closing. He said, my hands are tied. So the Savoy shut down. Why was this significant? Since its grand opening on March the 12th, 1926, the Savoy Ballroom, located on Lenox Avenue between 140th and 141st Street, quickly became the most significant cultural and social institution of Harlem and arguably of New York City. The great ballroom spanned an entire city block. Two large bandstands, richly carpeted lounges, and mirrored walls were in the building. At the Savoy's heyday, about 700,000 customers came to the dance Mecca every year. During the 1930s, the Savoy became the palace of big bands, jazz music, and dancing. No Harlemite could ever forget the legendary big band battle between Chick Webb and Benny Goodman's orchestras on May the 11th, 1937. Chick Webb won, by the way. In 1943, the Savoy's exclusive patrons numbered between 5,000 to 7,000, two-thirds of whom were African Americans. These included Orson Welles, Greta Garbo, Lana Turner, and even the rising Republican star in the state named Thomas Dewey, who would soon be elected governor. Hundreds of Harlem civic and social organizations rented the Savoy for their activities. In a period when downtown hotels and dance halls still remained segregated, the Savoy was the principal cultural center for interracial dancing and entertainment. The reaction of Harlem's political elite to the Savoy's closing was fierce. Powell's newspaper, The People's Voice, headlined, "What's behind the Savoy closing? Is it police move to bar whites from Harlem?" The People's Voice launched its own investigation of, quote, downtown dance halls, predictably finding that prostitution downtown was widespread. The Savoy Ballroom remained closed throughout the summer of 1943. On October the 15th, 1943, police announced that the establishment's license had been renewed and the Savoy's grand reopening occurred on October the 22nd, 1943. For Malcolm Little, the public debate over the closing of the Savoy was clear evidence of the limitations of white liberalism's racial tolerance. This is what Malcolm says in his autobiography, quote, "During World War II, Mayor LaGuardia officially closed the Savoy Ballroom. Harlem said the real reason was to stop Negroes from dancing with white women. Harlem said no one dragged white women in there. Adam Clayton Powell made a big fight. He had successfully fought Consolidated Edison and the New York Telephone Company until they hired Negroes. Then he had helped to battle the U.S. Navy and the U.S. Army about their segregating of uniformed Negroes. But Powell couldn't win this battle. City Hall just kept the Savoy closed for a long time. It was just another one of those liberal North actions that didn't help Harlem to love the white man any," unquote. Only weeks following the Savoy Ballroom's closing, in May 1943, the LaGuardia administration made public its agreement with Metropolitan Life Insurance Company to construct Stuyvesant Town, a semi-public housing complex located on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. MetLife had received from the city generous tax exemptions, eminent domain authority, and control of tenant selection. When it became clear that Metropolitan Life Insurance intended to keep black tenants out, no blacks could live in Stuyvesant Town. African Americans and many white liberals were outraged. Powell accused LaGuardia of once again capitulating to white racism. His newspaper boldly editorialized, quote, "Hitler won a victory in New York City." At one mass rally that attracted 20,000 people, Powell demanded LaGuardia's impeachment. It was not until 1944 that LaGuardia brokered a so-called compromise. Stuyvesant Town was constructed under the original terms with Metropolitan Life Insurance. However, the mayor signed Local Law Number 20, barring all future racial discrimination in tenant selection for housing projects constructed under the city's authority by private corporations. When the Detroit race riot of June 1943 erupted, New York City's authorities should have recognized that the conditions for a similar insurrection were ripe in Harlem. In only its first 6 hours, the toll from Detroit's unrest amounted to 34 deaths, over 700 injured, with $2 million of property damage. 5,000 federal troops were needed and sent into Detroit to patrol the city streets. Military vehicles were assigned to escort trolley cars and buses. Harlem's turn came on August the 1st, 1943. When a policeman shot a black serviceman in uniform, Robert Vandy, who was attempting to protect his mother from police arrest. Rumors that Vandy had been murdered prompted thousands of Harlemites into the streets, seeking retaliation. Within minutes, general rioting erupted. White-owned businesses along 125th Street and on Harlem's major north-south boulevards, Lenox, 7th, and 8th Avenues, north from Central Park up to 145th Street, were attacked. Hundreds of businesses within minutes. Before midnight, 1,450 stores had been vandalized and looted. 6 people had been killed, nearly 200 people seriously injured. Over 600 Negroes were incarcerated by the NYPD. Significantly, unlike the 1935 race riot, eyewitness accounts of the 1943 insurrection describe the rioters as both middle class as well as lower class Negroes. Even one 1943 police report of the violence recognized, quote, "those actually committing malicious acts of violence were irresponsible, ignorant individuals. But the probability is that many decent citizens were in various groups who, in the most instances, are intelligent and law-abiding, and while not actually taking part in the physical disturbance, aided and abetted indirectly in said disturbances," unquote. So in effect, the overwhelming majority of middle-class blacks supported the rioting. They were angry, they were fed up with the administration, they were tired of the police brutality, and they were tired of the racial discrimination that was supported by the LaGuardia administration. In the aftermath of the riot, Malcolm Little was walking, on the afternoon of the riot, the insurrection, Malcolm Little was walking south on St. Nicholas Avenue when he observed Negroes running uptown, quote, "loaded down with armfuls of stuff," unquote, along West 125th Street. He soon discovered, quote, "Negroes were smashing store windows and taking everything they could grab and carry, furniture, food, jewelry, clothes, whiskey," unquote. Within an hour, the NYPD dispatched what appeared to Malcolm to be, quote, "every New York City cop in Harlem." Malcolm colorfully described the semi-comic scene of NAACP head Walter White accompanying the diminutive Mayor LaGuardia driving along 125th Street in a huge, bright red fire car, pleading over loudspeakers to all of those, quote, "shouting, milling, angry Negroes to please go home and stay inside," unquote. Malcolm probably would have agreed with Powell's explanation about Bandy's reasons for resisting arrest by the NYPD. This is what Powell had to say, quote, "he was not mad with him only for arresting a colored woman, but he was mad with every white police officer in the United States who had consistently beaten, wounded, and often killed colored men and women without provocation. When rioters were smashing windows, they thought they were breaking the skulls of race haters and race baiters," unquote. It is from that vantage point of Harlem's mounting racial grievances, unemployment, discrimination, widespread unemployment, the controversial closing of the Savoy Ballroom, the Stuyvesant Town Agreement, and the August 1943 race riot, that Malcolm Little's actions regarding his military induction should be considered. In the autobiography of Malcolm X, Malcolm recalled Shorty Jarvis's attitude about the outbreak of World War II approvingly. This is what Shorty said, quote, "Whitey owns everything. He wants us to go and bleed for him. Let him fight," unquote. Although the autobiography makes no mention of it, Malcolm Little may have heard about the well-publicized case of an African-American, Winfred W. Lynn, who had refused to be inducted in September 1942 because of his opposition to racially segregated military units. Lynn eventually lost his case, but his protest had provoked widespread sympathy among black Americans. By 1943-1944, dissent among blacks within the armed services had escalated. Hundreds of black soldiers were simply going AWOL from their segregated army units. There were also, according to historian Harvard Sitkoff, an unusually high number of casualties experienced by white officers of segregated black units. In other words, fragging officers, right? When the military's induction notice addressed to Malcolm Little arrived at his sister Ella Collins's home in Boston, in Roxbury, she had informed authorities that her half-brother no longer resided there. When Malcolm eventually received the notice of induction, he decided he would avoid military service by any means necessary. The legend of Detroit Red, depicted in the autobiography of Malcolm X, presents a classic trickster tale of guile, comedic deception, and ultimate vindication for the hero. Quote, "I had about 10 days before I had to show up at the induction center," Malcolm writes. "I went right to work." Malcolm knew that Harlem was filled with military intelligence soldiers, quote, "those black spies in civilian clothes." He spread out the word on the streets that, quote, "I was frantic to join the Japanese army." Of the date of his scheduled induction, October 25th, 1943, Malcolm wrote, quote, "I costumed like an actor. With my wild zoot suit, I wore the yellow knob-toed shoes, and I frizzled my hair up into a reddish bush of conch." He addressed one white soldier sitting at the reception desk. "Crazy-o, daddy-o, give me moving. I can't wait to get into that brown." Eventually pulled from the induction line, the zoot-suited hustler was interrogated by a military psychiatrist to determine his fitness to serve. Malcolm rambled incessantly. Then Malcolm astutely whispered in the psychiatrist's ear, "Daddy-o, now you and me, we're from up north here, so don't you tell nobody. I want to get sent down south. Organize them nigger soldiers, you dig? Steal some guns and kill us some crackers." The psychiatrist, stunned senseless, uttered, "That will be all." The military psychiatrist judged Malcolm Little as 4F, unfit for military duty. A 4F card came to me in the mail, Malcolm concluded triumphantly. Quote, "and I never heard from the Army anymore and never bothered to ask why I was rejected," unquote. A subsequent FBI report dated January 28, 1955, confirms that Malcolm Little was rejected. Quote, "the subject was found mentally disqualified for military service for the following reasons: psychopathic personality, inadequate, sexual perversion, psychiatric rejection. The subject was classified for F on December 4, 1944, unquote. The FBI memorandum suggests that certain erotic elements of Detroit Red's trickster tale, the curious issue of sexual perversion, were deleted from Malcolm's own version of what had actually transpired. There was also a certain connection between the comedic zoot suit performance at the induction center and Malcolm's sandwich red routine for months that he had worked when he was working on the railroad. Both were disingenuous performances of black buffoonery designed to achieve different objectives: financial reward and a permanent deferment from military service. But both costume personas directly repudiated the militant, assertive black model provided by his father, the Marcus Garveyite. They also contradicted Malcolm's own growing political attitudes and evolving social consciousness, especially in the wake of the 1943 Harlem race riot. Adam Clayton Powell Jr.'s dramatic leadership during these years also deeply impressed young Malcolm, as subsequent events would show in the 1950s and 60s, when, by 63, a coalition is formed between black Muslim Malcolm X and Congressman Adam Powell. The hustler's creed of getting over through the art of deception fundamentally conflicted with the political heritage of Malcolm's parents and the example of Powell. Ultimately, Malcolm Little, who would become Malcolm X, would have to decide which model of black masculinity he would claim for himself. So that's the essay. What you get from the story is that Malcolm was largely formed by the experiences that he had in Harlem during World War II. But I also wanted to get across the kind of political and social and cultural dynamic of this important black neighborhood during this critical time. As we discussed last week, although most of what people know about Harlem really involves the Harlem Renaissance and the literature and the art of the 1920s, one can make a very good case that Harlem that we think of as the kind of archetypal, the template for black urbanism, is really formed not so much in the 20s, but more so during the Depression and World War II and the immediate aftermath in the 1930s and the 1940s. So let me stop. Do you have any questions? Everybody is like chilled today. Yeah. Do I see a hand? No hands? Yes, you have a hand. Yeah. Horace.
What was the response to the Martin administration to the riots? To what extent did they address?
What was the response of the LaGuardia administration?
After the riots, did they attempt to address any group?
They tried to. But, you know, black folk were very angry. And LaGuardia had messed up so many times. So once again, you have another commission. You have certain kinds of concessions. Black people, in part, in Harlem responded by ratcheting up the militancy. And they did it in a couple of ways. One, Powell gets elected to Congress the very next year in 1944. He becomes the second black person in Congress. And he serves in that capacity for a quarter of a century. Second, they elect Benjamin Davis Jr., who is the leader of the Communist Party in Harlem, to replace Powell in the city council. So Harlem is represented by a communist in the city council. So it shows the level of militancy and political development within this neighborhood. So that's part of what we're really looking at. Yes.
Revolution 31, was that a New York phenomenon, or was it a model copied from elsewhere?
Was what a...
Revolution 31, that Powell introduced to...
Yes. I'm not really sure. That I don't know. But, you know, Powell pressed the city council to initiate legislation to wipe out discrimination at all kinds of levels. Perhaps Powell was inspired by Roosevelt's executive order 8802, which had been essentially signed by Roosevelt in July 1941, that outlawed racial discrimination in hiring policies by military contractors that held federal defense contracts. Executive Order 8802 was the foundation of what we today call affirmative action and equal employment, equal opportunity employment legislation. Because what Roosevelt did was to establish the principle that businesses that have a federal contract could not carry out racial discrimination in hiring. This was the first time in American history where a president actually took this position and enforced it. And it had a huge impact on hiring. Something like 750,000 Negroes were hired by defense contractors during World War II. Other questions? Yes.
Could you possibly speak about the how the city shut down, the city of Philadelphia shut down because eight black male watermen were hired?
Yes. It's a sad story. Eight black motormen were hired. White motormen were outraged that niggers were hired for white men's jobs. And so they had a strike where they refused to drive the trolleys in Philadelphia. And the city was paralyzed for 6 days. Couldn't go to work, couldn't get to hospital, couldn't go to school. It was the trolleys that actually carried people back then. And so Roosevelt had to send in 5,000 federal troops. This is all over eight black employees. That's it. So I want to convey to you, you guys who live, who were born after the Civil Rights era, the depths of white racism in this country. And the reality of how deep it was that you would paralyze an entire city, costing millions of dollars of economic production during wartime over eight black men being hired. But that's what happened in Philadelphia, not Philadelphia, Mississippi, in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, the city of brotherly love. If you think it was bad in Philadelphia, just imagine what would have happened in Atlanta or in Birmingham. You know, the eight black men would have been lynched. Other questions? Okay. So what I tried to do, you had another question maybe. Yes.
You mentioned the Savoy being closed, and then you mentioned some of the regular.
Right. Tom Dewey.
Tom Dewey. Did any of these people at some point use their celebrity to
open it up?
Yes.
That I don't know. Maybe Dewey did. Maybe Dewey liked to swing or stomp. You know, there's that wonderful song, Stomping at the Savoy, you know, by Ellington, I believe, you know. But the Savoy was like a mecca for dance. It's hard to really convey it. But think of a place that attracts 700,000 dancers in every year. You know, they had to replace the ballroom floor of the Savoy once every 3 years. You know, and the floor was like this, but they would wear out the floor. And they had to put in a whole new floor. Because people would just use it up, right? This was the era of swing dance. You have big bands at two stages. The thing was massive, a whole city block, right? An entire city block with a dance floor that was absolutely massive, with mirrors on the wall and plush carpeting. Just incredible, right? In the center of Harlem. Yes. Yes, good question. Right. Right.
I don't know if this is anything that anyone else knows about, but in the last couple of years, the grounds of the Savoy Ballroom have been turned into a luxury apartment building.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered what you thought about that, the issues of gentrification that we were speaking about a couple of weeks ago, or what anyone else in the past thought about that.
Right. I'm not really so much bothered by that. The fact that where the Savoy was has been turned into now, I guess, a luxury apartment. You know, you close your eyes for a second in Harlem now, under gentrification. You have a whole new thing, you know. I saw the new building at 145th and West, 135th and 7th Avenue, right? There's like a building there. Yeah, right. On like the northwest corner or the northwest corner. But I'm not so much bothered by that. My problem is that when I walk on 5th Avenue between, where is that, 45th and 44th and 45th Street on 5th Avenue, that was the site of the colored asylum for children during the Civil War. And that's where 400 black children were burned alive by rioting whites during the Civil War. I don't believe there's a marker there, right? Is there a marker when you walk to the bottom of Wall Street where it converges with the East River that this was one of the largest slave markets in the New World for like 100 years? I don't think there's a marker there. So this is why, in part, black history gets eradicated, destroyed, distorted. And so the city makes no effort. They have monuments to all kinds of people, all kinds of criminals. Very rarely are there markers to everyday people and the ordeals that they have gone through here in the city or anyplace else in this country. There's no monument to slavery or the transatlantic slave trade in the United States, not that I know of. And yet it involved millions of people, and it took place over hundreds of years. Did you ever think about that?
Well, it's actually the African burial ground there. The periphery is technically all the African burial ground.
Yeah, but those were the Africans who died when they got here. I'm talking about the transatlantic slave trade, right? The slave trade itself. There's nothing. Nowhere in the country. I know this is kind of a downer conversation. Perhaps we should end on a lighter note. I had a feeling we would probably end early. All right. What we were trying to do is set the tone for what Harlem was like and why it was significant during this period. Now, next week, we're going to talk about the international dimensions of Harlem. We haven't talked about East Harlem, Latino Harlem. You're going to be reading material on that. We haven't talked yet about the African connections with Harlem. And so we're going to see Harlem transnationally in the reading. Now, in 1 month, you guys have to come up with what you want your paper to be or what your topic will be. You've been reading different materials. You've had an opportunity to think about it. But I would really like it if within the next 2 weeks you actually come up with what you want to do, because you will definitely need the period of time between mid-October to the end of November to put it together. If you wait until the end of October, you're only going to have 4 weeks. That may not be enough time. Okay? So you should be thinking about your papers. Do you have any other questions? Any other comments? Okay, John was a lot quicker than I thought, so I only prepared for about an hour. Yes?
Sorry, I have one more question. You had mentioned earlier on in your presentation that Harlem primarily consisted of Caribbean people.
No, I didn't say that.
One quarter.
Okay. One quarter. Yeah, I saw that. I don't really agree with that, because I think that what happens, especially for Caribbean immigrants, is that there's a dynamic of the first generation and the second generation. This is an oversimplification. And Horace, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but my own impression is that the first generation of immigrants frequently still identifies themselves with the country they came from. And so they're here to pick up some money, to earn money, ship it back home, and then return home. But what happens is that next year, they always plan to return home next year. Next year never comes, right? And the next thing you know, 30 years has gone by. And they've raised a family, and their kids have grown up, and they are now living in the United States. But there is still, ethnically, they still read ethnic newspapers. They still may speak the same language they spoke within their country. There's still an intense identification with what's happening in the mother country. The second generation of immigrants have a very different outlook. They're socialized in the United States. They have expectations of Americans nationally. They may feel a deep sense of cultural and social connection with where their parents came from. But they're not going to go back to that country because they never were from that country. They're from here. And so their expectations are here. And frequently, usually, they intermarry with people who are also frequently hyphenated Americans or African Americans. And so by the third generation, and also there's one other thing to consider, that in the United States, the great equalizer for black folk who are immigrants is white supremacy. That is, that you get judged not by your language, not by where you're from ethnically, not by what your passport says, but by the color of your skin. And it's not your fault. It's the fault of white racism. So that if you're Abner Louima from Haiti, or you're Amadou Diallo from Guinea, doesn't matter to the NYPD, right? They don't ask where you're from, or none of that. And so racism trumps those things. And young, second-generation black Americans who are from, whose ancestry is from outside of the United States, get treated and are related to by, you know, people like the NYPD as black Americans. No matter what you say you are. You can say whatever you want to say. You're a black American as far as they're concerned. And so consequently, since your life chances are affected by that, you begin to see the world through your life chances, just like any normal person does, right? You have to navigate your life within the society in which you find yourself. Maybe not the one you want to be in, but the one you are in. That's what changes things. So my wife was born in Jamaica, is proud of her Jamaican heritage. I love Jamaican culture, but she's a black American. And she functions that way. That doesn't negate who she is culturally. It's just the reality of her life. Because that's the reality of racism. And if you have something in your head, like Abner Louima, if you have something in your head that says, hey, I can be protected from that stuff, you're crazy, right? Because it doesn't work that way, right? It just doesn't. Maybe Clarence Thomas, it works that way. I don't know. You know, I wish it worked in a different way. Okay. All right, folks. So, you have a good week. I will see you next week with our speaker, Kimberly Johnson. Okay.